Hi, I'm John Green, and I am a lifelong learner. That's right, we've got new merch at Complexly.store. Welcome to Crash Course Religions. So listen, today we're talking about religious freedom, and to do that, we're going to start by talking about drugs. Like, is peyote, for instance, a sacred substance or an illegal drug? Peyote is an edible type of cactus, a few centimeters in size, that's been used for thousands of years in Native American religious ceremonies. Many tribes think of it as an incarnation of the peyote spirit, and when you ingest it, you can speak directly to God. But in 1990, two men in Oregon were prosecuted and fired from their jobs for participating in this ceremony, which raises big questions about religious freedom, like, do we have it? And what are the limits? So, okay, I believe in religious freedom, and that's something I'm comfortable saying because it's not a particularly controversial position, right? But it's when we start to try and define religious freedom and its limits that we find ourselves in tricky territory. Territory that forces us to ask hard questions, like, are there any cases when a person's religious beliefs should exempt them from the law? And what happens when one person's religious freedom makes it harder for another person to exercise theirs? Or makes it harder to access government services? These questions are both older than my country, the United States, and in some ways, more topical now than they've ever been. Religious freedom is something the United States has prided itself on since almost the beginning. I mean, it's right there in the First Amendment of our Constitution, along with the freedom of speech, the press, and assembly. It's usually understood as the right to believe and practice, or abstain from, religion without interference or persecution. So this constitutional protection in the First Amendment means there can be no official religion in the United States, which certainly isn't true for all countries. A major alternative to religious freedom is religious nationalism, which is super complex and can be understood in a number of ways, but one simple definition is when a government recognizes one religion over others, deeming only members of that religion to be worthy of protection, equipped for leadership, and essentially fully valid as citizens. Now, of course, the US was founded on the idea that this wasn't the way to run a country, right? The pilgrims left England and came to the New World in search of religious freedom, or at least that's the story we've heard. But here's the rub. Religion in the colonies had a very narrow definition at the time, right? Like, 8 of the original 13 colonies had official churches, just like England did. What I'm saying is, the Mayflower didn't exactly come over with like a coexist bumper sticker on it. It wasn't until folks like Thomas Jefferson started talking about separation of church and state in the late 18th century that anything resembling our modern understanding of religious freedom existed, at least in the United States. And even then, we often fell short of our promises. In much of the South, for example, there were laws restricting African-American religious practices, such as one policy in Georgia that made it illegal for any person of color to preach, to exhort, or join in any religious exercise with any persons of color, either free or slave, there being more than 7 persons of color present. Folks in power were concerned that these religious gatherings could lead to political organizing and revolts by enslaved people. After all, there were different biblical messages happening in these spaces. White pastors could emphasize the Bible's acceptance of slavery, or Jesus' teachings to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and so on, while black preachers were more likely to focus on Jesus' teaching that the last shall be first, that all are equal in the eyes of God, and that the poor and imprisoned are especially blessed. In any case, the Founding Fathers, with all their contradictions, were largely inspired by Enlightenment ideas first brought forward in Europe. They hoped that by protecting the freedom to worship as you pleased in what was already becoming a religiously diverse country, they could avoid the kinds of endless wars Europe had faced in previous centuries. But just to be clear, religious freedom already existed in plenty of cultures before the Enlightenment. Like, going back to the 3rd century BCE in India, Emperor Ashoka, himself a follower of Buddhist teachings, declared freedoms for all religious sects to practice their own beliefs. And you know who else offered religious freedom to just about everyone? Taoists notwithstanding. Wait for it. The Mongols. That's right. This camera isn't just for humor and personal asides. It's also for shameless nostalgia grabs. There have also been plenty of communities that just didn't really conceive of religions as rivals with distinct claims on the truth. Places where religious freedom was just kind of implied. Like in Bengal, prior to the partition of India, Hindus and Muslims practiced overlapping customs, even meeting simultaneously in shared spaces of worship. And traditions like the Baha'i faith have long held that all religions extend from the same divine origin. So the promise of religious freedom is not a new idea and definitely not exclusive to Western society. And yet, despite its centuries-long history, nobody's quite mastered it yet. In the US, there have been some major flashpoints in recent decades with Supreme Court cases deciding and redeciding and redeciding how religious freedom gets enforced, what its limits are, and whose religious freedom trumps whose. Some have even argued that failure is inevitable. The legal scholar Winifred Sullivan wrote a book declaring religious freedom to be fundamentally impossible because it would require a definition of religion that everyone agrees on, and as we've seen throughout this series, you know, that's pretty challenging. But for a snapshot of ways we've tried religious freedom, let's start with the first Supreme Court case on religious liberty in 1879. The Civil War was still fresh on Americans' minds, and many had moved west in search of new lives, and in what was then just the territory of Utah, a man by the name of George Reynolds had been convicted of practicing polygamy, or being married to multiple people at once. Two people, to be precise. Probably not enough for a TLC show, but enough for a Supreme Court case. Reynolds argued that as a Mormon man, his religion compelled him to marry more than one woman, a practice that was illegal under U.S. law. Reynolds took his case all the way to the Supreme Court, arguing that the law violated his First Amendment right to the free exercise of religion. But ultimately, the court ruled that the First Amendment protected religious belief, but not necessarily religious actions if they violated the law. And with that, a new legal precedent was set, one that would go on to influence decades of religious freedom cases to come, the belief-action dichotomy. The ruling established that the First Amendment's guarantee to the free exercise of religion did not exempt religious people from the law. Reynolds had the right to believe in polygamy, just not to practice it. So according to the belief-action dichotomy, I can worship Diet Dr. Pepper if it becomes illegal, I just can't drink it. Still, there were tons of kinks to work out in how to apply this rule. Like in the 1960s, a Seventh-day Adventist named Adele Sherbert was fired for refusing to work on Saturdays, a day of rest in her religion, and she had trouble finding another job that didn't hold the same requirement, so she filed for unemployment benefits, which were denied on the basis that she hadn't accepted, quote, suitable work when offered. But then, in what would become a landmark decision, the Supreme Court ruled that the unemployment policy violated Sherbert's religious freedom. And this wasn't just her freedom to believe that Saturdays should be a day of rest, but also her freedom to act on that belief, and more to the point, her freedom to receive the same government benefits as any other citizen while also staying true to her religion. The Sherbert versus Verner case introduced a new precedent, compelling interest. Basically, if a government isn't going to make accommodations for religious actions, it better have a good, compelling reason. What is the good, compelling reason for polygamy being illegal? Too many TLC shows. They would take over. But listen, I don't always have good reasons for things, do you? Like, people don't make any sense, and governments are made out of people, so there were more kinks to work out, which brings us back to peyote. In 1990, Alfred Smith and Galen Black were fired from their jobs for taking the hallucinogen as part of a Native American religious ceremony. And like Sherbert, they too were denied unemployment benefits, in this case because they'd been fired for misconduct. But this time, the Supreme Court ruled against them. Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that the First Amendment, quote, does not insulate religiously motivated actions from laws unless the laws single out religion for disfavored treatment. It was kind of the opposite of the Sherbert case, and there are dozens of cases like this where rulings on religious freedom bounce back and forth over this very fuzzy line between belief and action. Now, a lot of people on both sides of the political aisle felt the Smith case was unfair, and they wanted more cases to be ruled like the Sherbert one so that freedom of religious practice and freedom of religious beliefs could be better protected. So a few years later, Congress passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which tried to make the whole compelling interest thing much less of a vibe and more of a law. But this continued to not exactly clarify things, because what did our friend Winifred tell us? Protecting religious freedoms is impossible. And yet, like Sisyphus, we gotta keep doing the thing. So RFRA aimed to strengthen religious freedom claims, and starting in the early aughts, more conservative Supreme Court justices were appointed, and then, we started to see a pretty significant shift. For most of the 20th century, the Supreme Court tended to rule in favor of about half of religious freedom claims. But in 2005, they upheld 81% of religious freedom claims. After that, religious freedom claims started clashing with a wider variety of rights. Like in 2014, the court ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby, a company whose Christian ownership disputed a law requiring them to provide employee health insurance with guaranteed birth control coverage. And that raised big questions about what was more important, an employer's right to exercise religious beliefs against birth control or an employee's right to access birth control. And in 2018, the court ruled in favor of a baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple on the basis of religious beliefs against homosexuality, which raised big questions about discrimination. Beyond that, contemporary legal scholars have argued there's an imbalance of religious freedom in our country, with conservative Christianity often getting special treatment. One off-cited example, in a 2019 case, the court ruled against a Muslim inmate who wished to have an imam present during his execution, despite permitting Christian inmates to have pastors at theirs. Or in a much broader case from 2018, the court upheld former President Donald Trump's blanket ban of travelers from Muslim-majority countries. Importantly, the ban was created, as stated by the then-president himself, as a ban on Muslims specifically. Although justified by the courts as a matter of national security, many opponents have claimed the case never would have stood a chance if it were attempting to ban Christians. So where does that leave us today? Are we any closer to understanding the limits of religious freedom? It's hard to say. Freedom of religion is a constitutional right, but it can't be enshrined without limits. If, say, your religious traditions necessitate killing people, that conflicts with other people's rights. That's an obvious example, but there are plenty of less obvious ones, as we've seen. Throughout history, religious freedom has been used as a tool of oppression to uphold the rights of some religions more than others, but it's also provided a space for the articulation of minority rights, making room for more people to live out their beliefs. We may not ever get it perfect, but maybe that's exactly the point. Keeping a flexible and nuanced view of religion and the law lets us hang on to a flexible and nuanced view of each other. The second we think we've reached a stable answer, we've boxed things in. So maybe the trick is just to keep going. In our next and last episode, we're going to switch gears a bit and talk about pop culture and religion. I'll see you then. Thanks for watching this episode of Crash Course Religions, which was filmed at our studio in Indianapolis, Indiana, and made with the help of all of these nice people. If you want to help keep Crash Course free for everyone forever, you can join our community on Patreon.